Okay, good morning everybody. I've asked them to, well, Trevor's asked them to put the air conditioning on, so hopefully that will happen, and then no doubt some people will be just great and other people will be too cold, but you know, we'll work it out. Thank you very much for coming. It's really nice to see all of you. Really appreciate it, and hello to the people who are on Zoom. There's still quite a few people who come in on Zoom. Let's hope that we are moving towards a less Zooming reality than a more Zooming reality. Who knows? But Be'ezrat Hashem, it should go in the right direction. Let's start with a couple of kind sponsorships. The whole of 2020-21 is being sponsored very kindly, anonymously, in the merit of an aliyah for the neshamas of Matisyahu ben Yisrael, Aaron ben Menachem Lev, and Eliana bat Yaakov. Very grateful for that sponsorship. And the sponsorship of the live shiur is being given this week by Shimshon Grenek. Thank you very much for that sponsorship. In loving memory of his mother, who is Simcha Bas Sarah, whose Yahrzeit is actually today. The 23rd of June is today. It's Yud Gimel B'Tammuz. So really grateful for that sponsorship. Thank you. And just to remind people, you can sponsor the live shiur. The Zoom shiurim are sponsored through the year, but the live shiurim are available to be sponsored for anyone who is interested. Today, we're going to have a lot of fun, I think, or I'm going to try to have a lot of fun. I hope you do too. Next week, we're really moving into the crux of the matter, the controversial issue of Geirus in Israel and the problems that we're facing, the solutions that have been proposed, the hashkafic battles that are still being waged between different parts of the Orthodox establishment as to the modern day question, which is not really who is a Jew. That's not really a question so much as it was at the beginning of the state, but who is a ger? What do you need to do to convert? And there's been an enormous movement on that particular issue over the last 30, 40 years, and we're going to talk about that next week. The two key controversial questions on Geirus, which we're building up to, it takes a little bit of time, but next week should be the last week in the series. I might do 1 week after that on the Ethiopian community, we'll see. But the two main questions at the crux of the matter are as follows. Number one, how much does one need to accept in terms of Kabbalat HaMitzvot? How religiously observant does one need to be to qualify as a valid convert? We'll get to that at the end of today. And the second question is, what about people who are converting very clearly for ulterior motives? They're only converting because, ... They want to marry this woman, they want to, you know, have these rights, or whatever it is. We'll talk about that. These are not new questions, but they all converge on the new reality of conversion in Israel, which is we are going to talk about Be'ezrat Hashem next week. But this week is the last, if you like, of the theme setters, but we're going to have a lot of different ideas. We're going to be speaking about conversion, not just in terms of the details of Mila, Korban, Tvila, and Kabbalat HaMitzvot, but we're also going to be talking a little bit about the world of Korbanot, of sacrifices, of offerings generally, when do we ever get to talk about that? A little bit of the world of Tumah and Tahara, the purity and impurity laws, when do we ever get to talk about that? And also, if you'll allow me a 5-minute discourse in the middle on American evangelical history, people who are trying to convert Jews to Christianity, not talking about present-day situations at all, and the mid-19th century climate of non-conformism and excitement that led to the British, the French, etc. coming to Israel. You'll see what that has to do with anything as we get there. Okay, and a little bit of American politics thrown in. Not current American politics, but mid-19th century American politics. Much safer to talk about. Okay, fine. You'll see what's that got to do with Geirus. What's that got to do with anything, we will see in a little bit. Let's start at the very beginning. Look on the sheet, please. Let's use this Rambam in number one, which was on last week's sheet, but we never read it. And let's use this as a platform to start what we're doing today. Says the Rambam, he summarizes here the halacha, and you'll be familiar with this now having listened to the last couple of shiur. Number one, in Hilchas Isurei Bia, because the Rambam is here interested in which are the relationships which are permitted and not permitted, and hint of that he brings in a non-Jewish relationship, and then he talks about Geirut. Three things were necessary for the Jews to enter into the covenant. The Mila, Utfila, the Korban. Mila, circumcision, Tfila, which is going to the mikveh, immersion in the mikveh, and Korban bringing a sacrifice. That. Mila. So where was this Mila? He goes through historically. And from all of these details, we're going to see important factors for today's year. Mila, when was the circumcision? Haitha ben Mitzrayim. That was much earlier. Remember, they left Mitzrayim at Pesach. They only received the Torah, became Jewish at Shavuot, there's a 7-week difference between them. So the Mila was in Mitzrayim, Shneimah, V'chol Arei Lo Yochel Ba. And you see here that the Bris Mila in Egypt was not just to be able to eat from the Korban Pesach, but was also the Bris Mila of their conversion. We don't always focus on that. And that's important because we're going to be talking today about what is the status of a male convert between the Bris Mila and the Tefillah. You'll see why is that important. We'll talk about that soon. Mal oisam Moshe Rabbeinu give them all Bris Mila in Egypt. Kulam bitlu Bris Mila b'Mitzrayim. None of them did Bris Mila in Egypt. Chutz mishevet Levi. Apart from the tribe of Levi, va'alzenema uberitzachayim soru. Interesting. The Rambam brings in a midrash. Why are we talking about a midrash in the halakha? We'll talk about that midrash soon. The tribe of Levi did perform Bris Mila in Egypt. Why is that important? We'll see. Gimel. Utfila, where was their immersion in the mikvah? Haita b'midbar, they did that in the desert. Kodem matan Torah shneimar, before they went to receive the Torah, because it says, v'kidashtam hayom u'machar, you must sanctify yourselves today and tomorrow. V'kitzu simlotam, and they must, and it's v'kidashtam, so you must sanctify them today and tomorrow, and they must launder their clothes. Okay, so maybe they went to the laundromat. In the desert. So Chazal discussed this in the Gemara there, and they understand, no, that means mikveh. Whenever you get a korban which requires sprinkling of anything on the people, which it was in the conversion process in the midbar, there has to be a mikveh beforehand. So that's the mikveh. The korban, well, how do we know they brought a korban at Sinai, Shenemar, v'yishlachet na'arei b'nei Yisrael, and Moshe sent the youths, which is the firstborn of the b'nei Yisrael, v'yalu alot, and they brought olot. Ali they call Israel hikrivum, and they were bringing those sacrifices on behalf of all the Jewish people, who therefore be converted through a Brit Mila in Egypt, a mikveh before Sinai, and a sacrifice brought on their behalf. Fight, Dalek. V'chein adorot, so too for all generations. Kishirit yirte ha'akum liikaneis lebrit, when a non-Jew wants to join the covenant, v'lehit tofet tachat kamfei ha'shechina, and to be gathered under the wings of the Shechina, Yikabel alav ala Torah, and he, all Torah, sorry, and he accepts upon himself the yoke of Torah. Interesting, the Rambam doesn't put that as a fourth requirement. He doesn't say Mila, Tfila, Korban, and you have to accept the mitzvahs. Accepting the mitzvahs is a prerequisite. It's the fundamental, it's the basis. Meaning, unless you accept the mitzvahs, there's nothing to talk about. Once you accept the mitzvahs, then you have to do these three technical things. Once he decides to do that, Tzarech Mila, he needs to have a circumcision, Utfila, and an immersion, Ulahatzad, Korban, he has to have a Korban, Ve'im Nekezahi, and if it's a lady who wants to convert, Tfila, the Korban, it's just Tfila and Korban, they do not need Brit Mila, obviously, Shineimar, Kachem, Kager, and the whole thing is based on this idea that the Torah says, Kachem, just like you did it, Kager, so the Ger does it. You did these things to become Jewish, so the Ger does these things too. We talked, I don't know how long ago, a year ago, about whether the Avot were Jewish. Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef. That's a big question, because people assume Abraham was the first Jew. It's not so straightforward. Was he Jewish? Was he not non-Jewish? Was he Jewish? Was he somewhere between the two? This becomes a big deal, and we talked, when we talked about this, about the status of a Ben Noach, and the Brit of Avram Avinu, according to the Parashat Drachim, one of the commentators on the Torah, this question, are we Jewish or are we upgraded non-Jews? Are we proto-Jews or post-non-Jews? This debate was the debate between between the brothers and Yosef, between Yehuda and Tamar, Reuven, Bilhah. He fits this into the whole, much of Parashat Sefer Bereishis, that's the discretion, but I'm not going there now. Fine. So if it's a woman, she doesn't need Tfila and Korban. Okay, fine. Ma'atem ba'mila, just like you did through Mila, Tfila, v'ha'as, as Korban, apager, ledorot, so too for all generations, b'mila, Tfila, v'ha'as, Korban. Now, what was the Korban? Hey, to finish off this Rambam, umahu Korban hager, what was the Korban of the ger? Olat sehema, he had to bring an animal as an ola, as a burnt offering, all offered and not eaten, or shtei torim, or he has to bring two doves, to turtle doves or pigeons, for shnehem ola. I think I made a mistake last week. I think I said that one of these birds was an ola and one was a chatat. That's normally the case. Here, not the case. With a ger, if he wants to bring two birds, and by the way, it's an option. Sometimes there's a kind of korban where it's according to your sort of tax bracket. A korban oyle v'yoret. Meaning if you're rich, you bring an animal. If you're poor, you bring birds. If you're very poor, you bring flour. Not so here. The ger has a choice. It's up to you.
If you want to bring an animal, if you want to bring two birds, that's all fine. Ubizman has their important line. And what about today? Shein sham korban. He can't bring the korban. Sarich mila v'tzvila. You have to bring, you have to do mila and tzvila. Ukashi yibane beis hamikdash. Yavi korban. It's not that you don't have to bring a korban. You do have to bring a korban if you're a ger. But you can't. You're just held back. But as soon as the beis hamikdash is there, you better be running towards the beis hamikdash with your money for your birds or your animal. Otherwise, you're maybe not going to be Jewish anymore. Is that true? We'll see. Is someone who became a ger but didn't bring the korban fully Jewish? We'll see about that a little bit later on. Fine. Let's go over. Okay. Korban. Page number 2. So as I said, we never really get to speak much about korbanot. This year is titled Halachic and Hashkafic Issues in Contemporary Society. We did talk very many years ago about whether you can still bring Korban Pesach today. Maybe you could still, in theory, bring Korban Pesach today. That was one of the earliest shirim we had back in 2016. But apart from that, korbanot for us is really a theoretical exercise, but an important one. By the way, why does the Gemara cover the Mishnayot in Kodshim? They're not relevant anymore. Certainly not in Babel. Certainly not 300-400 years after the temple was destroyed. There's no Gemara on Taharot, for example, of Tumah and Tahara. It's irrelevant in Babel. There's not even any Yerushalmi on Taharot. But there's no Bavli on Zeraim. There is Yerushalmi on Zeraim because in Israel they had to keep Shemitah and Trumas and Maisas. But the Bavli is not relevant anymore. We live in Babylon. There's no Trumot or Masra. But there's Gemara on Kodshim. Why? Why did it go through Zvachim and Menachos and Tamura and Bechairet? The answer is because the Chazal clearly say that anyone who learns and studies Kodshim, it's as if they brought the Korbanos. There's no idea that if you learn about Shemitah, it's as if you kept Shemitah. Or if you learn about planting trees, it's as if you planted a tree. It's to plant a tree, to plant a tree. But to bring a korban, you can either bring the korban or you can learn about it. That's why learning about korbanot actually does have relevance, and that's why it's in the davening, the very beginning of the davening. You know, Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, used to say, when people come late to shul, the first thing they sacrifice is the korbanos. Okay? And it's true. But if you remember at the beginning of the Siddur there, we say the korbanos every morning in order to reenact, if you like, the bringing of the korban. Number 2. Elamit Acha says the Gemara, well, 1 second. The Ha'idna, nowadays when there is no temple, says the Gemara, the lake of Korban, you can't bring a Korban, loin akabah gerim, then we should be closed to gerim, no more gerim. Amar Acha Yaakov, no. Because it says in the Pasuk, ki yagur itchen ger, if a ger wants to join you, or Asheb Atochachem, or anyone within you, ledoroteichem, for all generations, okay, shkoyach. So there's a limud in the Torah. That not only at the time when you can bring a korban, but even after. So Tana Rabbanan, so the rabbis taught, Ger Bizman Hazer, Sarek Shi Yafrish Yuvah Lekino. So a Ger today has to already put the money aside. You know, when he comes back from his conversion or her conversion, has to take a little bit of money in the drawer, labeled, for when the Beis HaMikdash is built, this is for my korban. That's what they have to do, they have to have it ready. You don't want to be caught without any cash. When the Beis HaMikdash is there, all of a sudden, you can't, no. So Amar Rav Shimon, Rav Shimon says, bad idea. Kvar nimna alav Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, this didn't last very long. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is already the generation of the Chorban. He said, no, Ubatla, he cancelled this. He says, it's a bad idea. Mipni hatakala. Because it's going to cause you problems. Why? Because you're going to forget about it. You're going to say, oh, look, there's 100 shekels in the drawer. I can't remember what that is. You're going to spend it in the makolet. And you've just done me'ila. This money is for kodshim. Better not to have any money set aside for kodshim in your house. And Rab Amar Rab Idi Bar Gershom, Amar Rab Ada Bar Ava, Halacha Kreb Shimon. This is the halacha. Fine. So these days, Gerim do not separate any money. They just manage without the korban. But do they manage? We'll see. Look at now, number 3. Says the Mishnah as follows. Arba Mechusarei Kippurim. What is a Mechusarei Kapara? There are certain people who, in order to become Tahor, to become pure, how does one normally become pure? So there are 2, 3, or 4 stages. Okay? There is mikvah. There is the sun going down. That's usually what one needs to do. If, let's say, somebody touched a dead sheret and they become tamei sheret, they just run to the mikvah during the day. Let's say I touched the sheret now. It's 10:30 and I'm planning to go to the Beis HaMikdash tomorrow. So I have to run to the mikvah sometime between now and sunset and then wait for the sunset and then I'm good to go. Sometimes you need to do extra stuff, like with Tamei Meis, sprinkling on day 3, day 7, last week's Parsha. But sometimes, in order to become totally pure, you need to bring a korban. And that's called a mechusar kapara. Someone who needs to bring a korban. Let's see what this means. Number 3. Arba mechusar kippurim. Elohim. These are the list of mechusar kippurim. Hazav, hazava, hayoledet, v'hamatsora. These 4 kinds of people cannot become totally pure until they bring their korban. Meaning, someone who's tamei meis, there is no korban. Once you've done everything you need to do, you've been sprinkled, you've been tamikva, you're good to go. 7 days, you're good. No korban. But if someone is a zav, who is a man, who has his reproductive system is malfunctioning, there's something going wrong, there's actually a disease there as well. Or a zava, who is a woman who's experiencing uterine bleeding at the wrong time of the month, there's something wrong, it's not working properly. Nida is when a woman bleeds at the correct time, at the expected time. Zava, something's gone wrong. Yoledet is someone who gives birth, a woman who gives birth. And a matara is someone who has tsaras, leprosy or whatever it is. All these people need to bring a korban in order to eat their kodshim afterwards. Fine. Why are we interested in this? Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, ger mechusi kapara. No, I'm adding a fifth. A ger is also mechusi kapara, ad sheyizrak alav adam. Until the blood is sprinkled for the ger, he's also mechusi kapara. Okay, very nice. What does that mean? Does that mean a ger is now like a zava, a yoledet or a metzera? Meaning a zav is Jewish. He just needs to bring a korban. A zava is Jewish. She just needs to bring a korban. So do we say this is what he means? A ger is Jewish. He's just mechutzei kapara. What can a ger not do? He can't eat from korbanos. Okay, shkaya. So he doesn't care. There's no Beis HaMikdash anyway. When the Beis HaMikdash is built, the first thing he or she will do is bring their korban, and then they can eat from korban. Says the Rambam, no, that's not the pshat. Look in the Rambam. It's amazing Rambam number 4. Ger shemal v'taval, a ger today who had circumcision, v'taval, and who goes to the mikveh, the adayin lo hevi korbano, and he or she has not yet brought their korban, Af al pi shehu asur le'echol b'kodshim. You're right. He's not allowed to eat kodshim. He can't eat from, sacrificial foods, whatever, the korbanos. Ad sheyavi korbano, until they bring their korban. He says, but don't think what you're thinking. Einu min chusek rakapara. It's not because he's on this list of people who are not yet fully tahor. You might think that. We don't paskin that way. We paskin like the first few in the Mishnah. So why can't he eat kodshim? So look at this. Shekorbono, because his korban akfolios ger gomor. His korban stops him from being a true ger. The reason he can't eat korbanos is not because he's Jewish, but mechuse kapara like the others. He can't bring korban. He can't eat kodesh because he's not really Jewish yet. Until you've brought your korban, you're not really Jewish. Leos kakal kasher yisrael. He's not like a real Jew. That's why he or she can't eat kodshim. They're not like a full-blown Jew. The cave and shiyavi korbana. As soon as you can bring the korban, the yad to Israel, kosher, then you become a kosher Jew. Oichel b'kodshim, then you can eat kodshim. So this is a pretty scary Rambam, which means that a ger is Jewish, but not completely Jewish. He's as Jewish as you can be, but not as Jewish as somebody else. Which, of course, is not what he said to Avadi the ger in his letter last week. And it could be that the Rambam is saying this only when there's a Beis HaMikdash, and not when there's no Beis HaMikdash. But there is this shaila, I just wanted to bring you here. The Korban is a real thing. The Rav Avadi B'Bar Tanura says, no, don't worry. Even without the Korban, you can still eat kodshim. You just can't marry a Jewish woman. Oh, shkaya, that's really helpful. Now I'm relieved. Now I can eat kodshim. You just can't get married. That's a bit of an own goal if you become a ger, and then, there's good news and there's bad news. You're Jewish, but you can't get married. No, so we paskin lemaisa that a ger before a korban, he can get married, she can get married. As far as kodshim, okay, they can't eat it. So if you're a ger or if you know a ger, then make sure that they've got some plans. Don't put the money aside yet because that's bad news. But make sure that the first thing that's going to happen when the Beis HaMikdash is built is you'll be in there with your 2 birds or your animal. By the way, there are people who are breeding the correct breed of pigeon and turtle dove. So that we will have exactly the right things to bring when we need to bring korbanos. You might think, that's a bit loopy. Why would you do that? The answer is, why would you not do that? We'll all look like a right bunch of Charlies if we're ready to bring our korbanos, and someone says, we've got no pigeons. We don't know if they're the right ones. Okay, we've got to be prepared. Especially Gerim. Gerim should be investing in this. In pigeon breeding and working exactly out. Not to mention the big day kahuna, There are many Kohanim living today who have hanging up somewhere a pair, a set of Kohen clothes. I think Rabbi Riskin has a set, this one has a set, that one has a set, all ready to go. We don't want to be caught without proper preparation when the Beit HaMikdash is built. But anyway, you see the Korbanos issue is very interesting. You're a Jew, but maybe not completely a Jew until you bring the Korban. Okay, let's get on to more relevant ground for today, which is Mila. Everybody knows what Bris Mila is. We do it to little Jewish boys all the time. But what is the status of a non-Jew who did Mila but didn't yet get to the mikvah? Obviously, by definition, we're talking about a man. Over the page, please. Page 3. 6. Ger Shemal V'loy Tavol. A Ger who had Mila but not Tfilah. Or alternatively, Tavol if they did Tfilah first. V'loy Mal, but they didn't yet have Mila. Eino Ger, they are not Jewish. Add until she yamol the yitzbol. He has to be yamol the yitzbol. He has to be circumcised. He has to go to the mikveh. But tarich litzbol is neishloishen. You have to do that in front of a beis din. We're not getting today into the beis din issue. We paskin that lachatchila, the Shulchan Aruch says, you should try and do all of the steps of conversion in front of a bet din. We'll see what is a bet din, who counts for a bet din. Does it mean dayanim or any three people like we would use for Taurus Nadarim, for example. But in principle, all of it needs to be done in front of three people, bet din, we'll define. But certainly the tefillah says the Rambam. Okay, fine. So what is the status of somebody between Mila and tefillah? So you said, well, we just read. He's not Jewish. You have to do both. You're not half Jewish. Well, there's an interesting question. What is the one thing that a non-Jew, from halachic point of view, is definitely not allowed to do?
Keep Shabbos.
Have a look in number 7. Amar Reish Lakish says the Gemara, Nochri Sheshavas. A Nochri, a non-Jew who decided they want to keep Shabbos. And this means halachic Shabbos. We're not talking about the Seventh-day Adventists. You know, you want to have a day, sit and watch movies, fine. But you want to keep Shabbos like a Jew? You can't do that. Chayiv Misa. You are liable to the death penalty. Shneimah, because it says in Noach, V'yom v'layla lo yishvotu. Now, of course, this is talking on a pshat level after the flood. God promises Noah, don't worry, there'll always be day, there'll always be night, I'm not going to destroy the world, but on a drash level, yom v'layla lo yishvotu. Do not rest day and night. Note the order, day and night. Amamar, and the Gemara then clarifies as hara shelahem zohi misasam, that I don't need, usually in the Torah, in order to have a penalty, you need a warning, and then a pasuk that brings a second time the penalty, says don't do this, and if you do it, you are chayiv misa, chayiv makos, whatever. With a non-Jew, we don't need that, we just need to be said once, and they're liable to death penalty. And Ava Ravina, and Ravina says, afilu sheini b'shabbos, even if they want to keep Shabbos on Monday. You can't keep Shabbos, Jewish Shabbos, not just Saturday. It's Monday. You can't keep a halachic Shabbos for a total day. That is called breaking whatever it means to keep Shabbos. You're not allowed to do that. We had I mentioned to you last week or 2 weeks ago. We had a young lady living with us when we lived in London, and she was in a gerus process. She was an interesting situation. She grew up as a Jewish girl. And she became a Balat Shuva in her late teens. She became frum. She started keeping Shabbos. And she was very excited. And then a relative tapped her on the shoulder and says, listen, I've got bad news for you. You didn't used to care when you were not so religiously observant. But I've got to tell you now, you're not actually Jewish. Your mother had a, you know, dodgy conversion. Some sketchy thing went on. Some back in the day. You're not Jewish. So she said, okay, bit of a shock. But she went to the Beis Din. She went to the London Beis Din. And she says, I want to convert. So the London Beis Din said, fine. And they weren't particularly, strict on her because I don't have a question, does she want to be Jewish? She always thought she was Jewish. I don't have any question, does she want to keep halacha? She became a Balat Shuva. Everything is good. So they said, look, go live with the Mannings for a few months, just a few months, and everything will be fine. I mean, that doesn't always work if you live with the Mannings for a few months in life. So I don't really want to have an influx of people. But anyway, she came to live with us. She was, you know, fine, but she wouldn't break Shabbos. I said to her, listen, you've got to break Shabbos. And she goes, no, all my life I broke Shabbos. I took upon myself not to break Shabbos. I'm not going to start now. I said, just carry a tissue. That was before there was an Erev. You see, there were things useful before they built the Erev. I said, no, I'm not going to carry a tissue even. So anyway, I went to see Dian Gelly at the Beis Din, and he said, how's it going? And I said, no, it's going fine. There's just one problem. She absolutely insists on keeping Shabbos. And I said, as far as I'm aware, that's a problem, right? You know, Chayv Misa, this is really terrible. He says, no, don't worry about it. I said, don't worry about it. Fine, but why? He says, listen, for a Jew, we say, Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Voker. The day starts in the evening. But for a non-Jew, Yom Valayla. The day starts, the halachic day starts at sunrise and ends at sunrise for a non-Jew. If a non-Jew were to keep Shabbos, they would have to keep it from Saturday morning to Sunday morning. That's the non-Jew's day. So when she makes Havdalah on Saturday night, she's breaking Shabbos. That's why these Dayanim are Dayanim. They got the answers, okay? Great answer. So there we are. That's it. And that's the halacha l'maaseh. Paskin, she was absolutely fine. Now, let me now take you on a little bit of an excursion back in time to 1848. In 1848, in Adar Sheni, a non-Jew was circumcised. It was actually a Tuesday. He wanted to convert in Yerushalayim. He was getting over his bris milah. Obviously, it takes a few days. He was still not able to go to the mikveh, and his mikveh was scheduled for the following week. Okay? So he's a man between milah. He's had his milah to convert, but he hasn't had his mikveh yet. So come Shabbos, he was a bit cold. It was Adar. It was in March. And he said, I'm a bit cold. I really need the fire on. I've just had an operation. I don't feel well. Am I allowed to ask a non-Jew to put the fire on? To light the fire? Well, at the time, Rav Asher Lemel was standing in as the Rav in Yerushalayim for Rav Shmuel Salant. Rav Shmuel Salant, who was the Rav of Yerushalayim in 1848, had gone on a trip to meet the first Gera Rebbe. So he was in Europe with the first Gera Rebbe, and they had a stand-in Talmud Chacham. So they went to ask Rav Lemel, can he, you know, ask someone to light the fire? He goes, what are you talking about? It's not that he can ask a non-Jew to light the fire. He's got to light the fire. He's got to light the fire? Yes, he's not Jewish. He had a circumcision, but he didn't go to the mikveh. He's not Jewish. He can't keep Shabbos. He mustn't keep Shabbos. He's got to light the fire. Anyway, they went back and they told him. He says, I'm not lighting the fire. It's ridiculous. How can I do that? So in the end, they made him do something. They all got all the Ziknei Yerushalayim, Zkenim of Yerushalayim, they got round, and they made him sign his name on Shabbos. So he signed his name. Oh, Baruch Hashem. He broke Shabbos. He's not yet Jewish. So the next morning on Sunday, when this got out to the Rabbonim in Yerushalayim, they went ballistic. They said, this was absolutely not the correct psak. It's not correct. A Jew who accepts to be Jewish, and he had a bris milah. Okay, he's not yet Jewish, but he's not non-Jewish either. And he is allowed to keep Shabbos. He's what they say officially, I think the official term is nishtahin and nishtaher. Okay? He's an in-betweener. He's absolutely allowed to keep Shabbos. You shouldn't have told him to sign his name. And they were very critical of it. So what they did is they sent a message to Rav Shmuel Salant, who was still in Poland with the Gera Rebbe, and Rav Shmuel Salant said, Gevalt, what kind of a psak is that? I left the Talmud Chacham in charge all of a sudden. And he paskened that he should not have signed his name, and the Gera Rebbe paskened that she should not have signed his name, and this became a big tumult. Rav Yaakov Esslinger, who was the Gadol Hador in Europe, who wrote the Ksav HaKabbalah, and the Oruch Lener, Rabbi Eklinger was asked the Shaila, and in the Binyan Sin he writes back and he says, this man should not have broken Shabbos. He's allowed to keep Shabbos. What was his proof? What is the status of a Jew between Mila and Fila? He says, go back to the beginning. Go back to the Rambam. The Jews received Brit Mila in Egypt. They only went to Mikveh at Sinai, Shavuot. And when did they receive the Mitzvah Shabbos? In the middle. At Mara. He says, it's black and white. Of course, a Jew who has had a circumcision but has not yet been to mikveh is allowed to keep Shabbos. And so he passed in that as well. Rav Shmuel Salant even said that he may be somewhat Jewish. Anyway, Rav Lemel didn't go quietly. He wrote another tshuva saying, I was absolutely right and everybody else is wrong. And this became a cause celebre. If you'd have been speaking the local, interesting Jewish ideas going on in the 1840s, 50s, this was the one thing that was on people's minds, or one of the things that was relevant. Can a Jew between Mila and Fila, can they keep Shabbos? Now, what I want to do with you is just turn for a second to the last page, where it says page 7. And I want to read with you page 7 and page 8 a little bit. I hope you'll excuse me while we talk about something which I think is fascinating. So it turns out that this non-Jewish man who caused this entire discussion reverberating between Europe and Israel was none other than a man called Warder Crescent. Warder Crescent. Anyone here heard of Warder Crescent? I'd never heard of Warder Crescent. Except I had heard of him, but I had forgotten that I'd heard of him. Let's have a look. First of all, I want to read with you the second paragraph, which is an English translation of something that the Oroclinaire of Ettinger wrote. He says, here in Jerusalem, second paragraph on page 7, the 23rd day of the month of Adar Sheni in the year 5608, that's 1848, a non-Jew came from Morocco and was circumcised for the sake of conversion and accepted all the mitzvot. On the following Shabbat, he had not recovered fully from the circumcision and does not enter the mikveh. A rabbi was informed that the convert is very careful in his observance of Shabbos. However, another rabbi claimed that due to the fact that he had not yet entered the mikveh, he must not observe the Shabbos and must perform one of the prohibited acts. It was late in the day, and the convert was told what he must do. Consequently, he violated the Shabbos by writing a few letters after the Shabbos. When the rabbis in town heard of the ruling, they disagreed, claiming that after circumcision he was considered a Jew and he must not violate the Shabbat. Okay, so far, so good. We know what we're talking about. But who was Warder Crescent? So let me give you a little bit of background and then we'll look at page 8. Warder Crescent was born in 1798 and grew up in America, in Pennsylvania. So you'll ask, what was he doing in Morocco on the way in? He grew up as a Quaker and then he grew up as a Shaker. Now, I'm not a big bucky on the difference between the Quakers and the Shakers. Maybe between them they know the difference. Of course, the Hebrew translation of to quake or to shake is lechared. Okay, so they're charedim. They are the original, or before, the modern-day charedim, and the Quakers and the Shakers are all quaking and shaking. He lived in Pennsylvania, and at the age of 30, he started preaching, and he said that Philadelphia was a Babylon of the 19th century. Now, that's not good. Babylon was usually a very bad place. He became good friends with the Rav of Philadelphia, early rabbi in the 1840s, a rabbi called Rabbi Isaac Lesser. And at the age of 46, in 1844, he decided he's got to do something to express his evangelical excitement. So he went to Washington, D.C., and he managed to get himself appointed as the first United States consul to Ottoman Jerusalem. He said, I want to be your ambassador in Jerusalem. I want to go to Jerusalem, and I want to convert the Jews. Okay, so they sent him to Jerusalem. Now go to page 8 and have a look. Let's pick up here. What's going on in Jerusalem? Well, let me give you a little bit of background before page 8. In the 1840s and 50s, a lot of people became very evangelical. In Britain, Lord Palmerston was the Foreign Secretary, and his son-in-law, step-son-in-law actually, was someone called the Earl of Shaftesbury. The Earl of Shaftesbury was a radical evangelical, non-conformist, very excited to convert as many Jews as he possibly can, and everybody started looking towards Jerusalem. The Russians wanted influence there, so they looked after the Russian Orthodox. The French wanted influence there, so they looked after the Catholics. The British wanted influence there, but they were no Protestants. So he says, who are we going to look after? The Jews. We're going to look after the Jews. And there was a rush by the Earl of Shaftesbury to try and get to the Jews in Jerusalem. And therefore they started a society called the London Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews, or the Jew Society. It's now called the Church's Ministry to the Jewish People, CMJ, still there. And the British went on a race to try and convert as many Jews as they could to Christianity. They built a hospital and they sent doctors and pharmacists. And there was a race between Montefiore, who was trying very hard to keep them Jewish, and Shaftesbury, who was trying very hard to make them Christian, and therefore Montefiore said, well, if you're going to build a hospital, I'm going to build a hospital. And that's how Misgav Ledach was built. Misgav Ledach was built in the 1850s there to try and get the Jews. You don't have to go to their hospital where the cross is on the wall and you're going to be a Christian. Come to our hospital and you're a Mulchedet. Mulchedet's a great kupa. It wasn't then Mulchedet, but Misgav Ledach was built then. Okay, fine. At the time, there was a fellow called James Finn who was head of this society to convert the Jews. Now turn to page 8. Now I'm going to read you this. This will blow your mind. On the one hand, this, by the way, is taken from a book which I read a little time ago by Simon Sebag Montefiore called Jerusalem, the Biography. I thought it was excellent, okay? And as I was reading this guy, Warder Crescent, I was thinking, I've heard about this guy, and I found that he was actually in this book. So read with me at the top of page 8, on the left-hand side. On the one hand, we're not going to read the whole thing, they aggressively protected the Jews. This is the church mission, who were brutally oppressed in Jerusalem. Yet at the same time, his pushy mission provoked violent Jewish resistance. When he converted a boy called Mendel Dignus, he caused mayhem as, quotes, the Jews climbed over the terraces and made great disturbances. You know, the political action didn't start now with Asifas and calls to prayer. Finn called the rabbis fanatics, but back in Britain, the powerful Montefiore, hearing the Jews were being harassed, sent a Jewish doctor and pharmacist to Jerusalem to foil the Jewish society, which in turn founded a hospital on the edge of the Jewish quarter. In 1847, a Christian Arab boy attacked a Jewish youth who threw back a pebble which grazed the Arab boy's foot. The Greek Orthodox, traditionally the most anti-Semitic, quickly backed by the Muslim Mufti and the Qadi, accused the Jews of procuring Christian blood to bake the Passover biscuits. The blood libel had come to Jerusalem, but the Sultan's ban granted by the Montefiore after the Damascus affair proved decisive. About 8 years earlier in Damascus, there was a very famous blood libel against the Jews. Montefiore managed to intervene to get it stopped, and the Sultan's decree worked here as well. Fine, go to the where it says water crescent. Really the last paragraph. Meanwhile, the consuls were joined by perhaps the most extraordinary diplomat in American history, I doubt, observed William Thackeray, the English author of Vanity Fair, who was visiting Jerusalem, that any government has received or appointed so queer an ambassador. Let's have a look at him. On the 4th of October, 1844, Walter Crescent arrived in Jerusalem as the U.S. Consul General of Syria and Jerusalem, his chief qualification for the job being his certainty that the Second Coming was due in 1847. Now, Lahavdil, 1847, 1848 was reverberating around everybody's mind. Because of the Vilna Gaon's predictions, Kol HaTor, people felt 1848 would be a very important year, and it turned out to be the year of revolutions, and it turns out there's a whole diyun in the works of the Gaon. They were right, but they were 100 years out. It was 1948 that proved to be the year of the Gaon, as they were looking at not 1840, but anyway, everybody was very excited at this time. Crescent took the consular hauteur of his European colleagues to a new level. He galloped around Jerusalem in a cloud of dust, surrounded by a little American army, who belonged in a troop of knights and paladins from a Walter Scott novel, a party of armed and glittering horsemen led by an Arab who followed by two janissaries with silver maces shining in the sun. So this fellow cut a really interesting figure. At his interview with the pastor, Crescent explained that he'd arrived for the coming apocalypse, always a good way to start the conversation, and the return of the Jews. A Philadelphia landowner, child of rich Quakers, Crescent had spent 20 years spinning from one apocalyptic cult to another after writing his first manifesto, Jerusalem, a Center of Joy to the Whole World, and abandoning his wife and six children, Crescent persuaded the Secretary of State, John Calhoun, to appoint him as a consul. Quote, I left everything near and dear to me on earth in pursuit of truth. The U.S. President, John Tyler, was soon informed by his diplomats that his first Jerusalem consul was a religious maniac and madman, and they sacked him almost as soon as they appointed him. But Crescent was already in Jerusalem, and he was not alone in his apocalyptic views. He was an American of his time. Skip a couple of paragraphs away. It says, in little wooden churches. In little wooden churches in one-horse mining towns, farmstead on the boundless prairies and gleaming new industrial cities, the preachers in the new promised land of America cited the literal biblical revelations of old. In no country, wrote Dr. Edward Robinson, an evangelical academic who became the founder of biblical archaeology in Jerusalem, are the scriptures better known. These first American missionaries believed that the Native Americans were the lost tribes of Israel, and that every Christian must perform acts of righteousness in Jerusalem and help the return and restoration of the Jews. I really wish the Jews again in Judea an independent nation. You want to know why there's American evangelical Zionist support for Israel? It starts here. It starts in the 1840s. They want the Jews to have it. Why? So that they can all convert to Christianity for the Second Coming, wrote the second U.S. President, John Adams. In 1819, two young missionaries in Boston prepared to put this into action. Every eye is fixed on Jerusalem, indeed the center of the world. Skip down to the last paragraph. Consul Crescent had ridden the wave of this flowering of prophecy. He'd been a Shaker, a Millerite, a Mormon, and a Campbellite before a local rabbi in Pennsylvania convinced him that salvation was of the Jews, to turn 90 degrees, please, whose return would bring the Second Coming. And this is when it gets quite interesting, if it wasn't interesting already. One of the first to arrive in Jerusalem was Harriet Livermore, daughter and granddaughter of a New England congressman. She set off in 1837 after years preaching to the Sioux and Cheyenne tribes. That's a good preparation for meeting the Jews of Jerusalem, I'm sure. That they were the lost tribes of Israel who should accompany her back to Zion. I don't think they came, but whatever. She rented rooms on Mount Zion to prepare her sect, the pilgrim strangers, for the apocalypse that she expected in 1847. But it did not come, and she ended up begging on Jerusalem streets. At the same time, Joseph Smith, prophet of the new revelation of the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, sent his apostle to Jerusalem. He built an altar on the Olivet to prepare her to restore Israel with Jerusalem as a capital. And if you know, there's a Mormon church on the Mount of Olives there. That is where it comes from. Now, by the time Crescent became the UN consul, a growing number of American evangelists were visiting Jerusalem to prepare for the end of days. The US government eventually dismissed him, but he continued defiantly to issue visas of protection to Jews for several years, and then, changing his name to Michael Boaz Yisrael, converted to Judaism. He was our guy, Bein Mila Letfila. He was the very one. For his long-abandoned wife, this was a revelation too far. She sued to have Crescent declared insane, citing his pistol-waving, street-haranguing, financial incompetence, cultic eclecticism, plans to rebuild the Jewish temple, and sexual deviance. I don't know anything about the last point, in case you were to ask. He sailed back from Jerusalem for the Inquisition of Lunacy in Philadelphia, a cause celebre, for Mrs. Crescent was challenging the constitutional right of American citizens to believe whatever they wished, the essence of Jeffersonian liberty. And in fact, this American insanity trial became the case of the 19th century in jurisprudence on the issue of the right to believe anything you want to believe and still to be an American. Therefore, this man was responsible on two continents for decades of important legal decision, one of them in America about the issue of freedom of right to religion, one of them in Israel about Malbim Otavol, okay? And what happened? At the trial, Crescent was found to be insane, but he appealed and was awarded a retrial. Mrs. Crescent had to deny either her savior or her husband, why he had to deny the one and only God or my wife. The wife lost the second case, confirming American freedom of worship, and Crescent returned to Jerusalem. Created a Jewish model farm near the city, actually in Emek Refaim. Next time you go to Emek Refaim, think of that. Studied the Torah, divorced his American wife, married a Jewess, all the while completing his book, The Key of David. He was honored by local Jews as the American Holy Stranger. On his death, he was buried in the Jewish cemetery on the Mount of Olives. And actually, in 2013, his grave was rediscovered in a new kind of mapping of all the graves there. And you can go onto Har Zeitzim to this day and visit the grave of Warder Crescent or Michael Boaz Ben Yisrael. There we are. What an interesting man. So I couldn't resist talking about him for just a little bit. This man who single-handedly excited the legal establishment on two continents. Fine. Let's get back to something more normal. Go back to page 3, please. Different question. What if a person, a non-Jew, wants to convert, but they can't have a bris milah? Why? Because they already had an operation when they were a child. Quite common. Used to be quite common. Much less so now. Or because maybe they have haemophilia, and it would be very dangerous for them. Or maybe because, loyalenu, they've been castrated, and there was no way that they could have a bris milah. Or because they grew up thinking they were Jewish, and they had a bris when they were 8 days old. All of these things happen. So let's look briefly at these halachas. Number 8, at the bottom of page 3. Ger shenichlas l'kal Yisrael. If a non-Jew wants to join the Jewish people, chayiv mila v'tchila, he first has to have mila. This is from the Shulchan Aruch. Has to have mila first. The immal tashehaya ovid kachav. If he'd already had a mila when he was a non-Jew, or a circumcision, I should say, medically, or, says the Ramosh, Nolad Mahul, there is a medical condition that one in every how many 100,000 babies are born without an orla, so they can't have an actual brit milah. Then what does he need to do? Tzarech lahatif mimenu dam brit, called hatafat dam brit. They need to create a little bit of blood, even a little bit of reddening of the skin. Ve'ein mevarchin alav. And there's no brocha. This is a machlokus in the Rishonim. Some Rishonim say there is a brocha, asher kidishanu Dambrit, but the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, no, we don't. We just do the Hatafat Dambrit. If he'd already had a Mila, he can still convert. Number 9. The Im, over the page. The Im Nichrat Hagid, and if, God forbid, he had no organ at all, he'd been castrated, then it's okay for conversion. Ein milato ma'akevet milihikaya. Then Brit Mila will not prevent him from being a non-Jew, being a Jew, sorry. The Sagi Leibet Tila. It's enough just with Tila. So either way, you seem to, it's okay. If you had a bris before, if you had a circumcision, they can get around that. It's fine. Hasafat dam bris. If, God forbid, you didn't have the ability of any kind, then fine. You can just do with tefillah without mila. What about a hemophiliac? So on the one hand, what's the din for a little Jewish baby? if you have a baby who had a medical problem, in the time of the Gemara it says if two brothers died, God forbid, from the Brit Mila operation, then the third one does not need and must not have a Brit Mila. Now today you don't have to wait for two brothers to die. You can diagnose, you can see, etc. So a baby who medically is unable to have a Brit Mila doesn't need a Brit Mila. But what is their status? Do they have the status of an RL? Meaning, okay, you're not able to have the operation, but you're not circumcised. You can't eat truma. For example, a Kohen who is an RL is not allowed to eat truma. So most of the Rishonim say that a baby, a Jewish baby, who was unable to have a Brit Mila, is yet called an RL. Meaning, it's not his fault, but the things he can't do, he's not circumcised. Tosfos says, no. An RL is somebody who could have had a Brit Mila, but didn't have a Brit Mila. And this baby, who could not halachically have a Brit Mila because of medical reasons, he's not called an RL. So what do we say here? With our non-Jewish man, on the one hand, a Jewish baby is Jewish one way or the other. The baby is born to the Shiloh. The question is not whether he's Jewish. The baby's for sure Jewish. There's a Jewish mother. We just have to do a Brit Mila. But with this non-Jew, it's the Brit Mila that makes him Jewish. So what are we going to say? Are we going to turn around and say, well, he can't have the Brit because of the medical danger? But if we say like Rashi, okay, but then you're still an RL, so you're still a non-Jew. You didn't make it. You didn't become Jewish. I'm sorry, you can't. There's nothing you can do. If we say like Tosfos, okay, you're not an RL. You just couldn't have the operation. Almost all poskim say that he is an RL and therefore a non-Jewish man who is unable for medical reasons to have a Brit Mila or a Hatafat Dam Brit is not able to convert. Now today there are other options. There are laser surgeries. Question is, does the laser surgery count as a Mila? If it's just a laser as opposed to a knife, one Shiloh. There you can give them coagulants. What does he need? He needs coagulants. They're not anticoagulant. He needs something to help his blood to clot. You can do that as well. There are other options today as well. What about a child, like the case of the girl that was staying with us, but a boy who grew up Jewish, but then he found out he wasn't Jewish. So he goes to the Beis Din and he says, okay, I need to convert. Okay, you need to have a Brit Mila. So, but I already had a Brit Mila. Okay, but it's, you know, it wasn't a real Brit Mila. Why? It wasn't like a non-Jew who had a medical circumcision as a non-Jew. I had a Brit Mila. They ate cholent and whatever it is they eat. In the morning, that's not my idea of a, you know, whatever. They ate cornflakes. They said brochas. They said the whole thing. And they had a proper Jewish Mila. So what do you say? On the one hand, can you count the Mila he had when he was 8 days old, which they thought was just a Mila, but turned out to be stage one of a circumcision, of a conversion. Can you count that for 20 years later when he does stage two, or not? Interesting question. Does it depend what the Moel had in mind? So what does the Moel have in mind when he does a Brit Mila? Hopefully that he wants to do it right. Okay? But what mitzvah does he... Is he having in mind, this is for the mitzvah of Brit Mila? Or if the Moel looks around the family and says, I'm not sure what's going on here, I don't even know if this baby's Jewish, I'm going to have in mind that it's maybe for Mila, but if not, then it's for conversion. Does that help? How are we going to answer that question? The answer is, what was the status of the Levim in Mitzrayim? That's what the Rishonim say. Go back to that Medrash. The Levim in Mitzrayim did not have a problem. They did circumcision. They did circumcision, says the Rambam. So when they came to Korban Pesach, did they need a Hasafat Dam Brit or not? Or were they good to go? They had circumcision, but not as converts, but as whatever they were then, pre-Jews. So that's the Shaila. If you say that they did not need a Hasafat Dam Brit, they were good to go for the Korban Pesach, then so too it could be that this baby who had a Brit Mila celebration, that was stage one, and he's good to go for the tefillah going forward. Very, very interesting. I brought you all the Midrashim. I don't want to go through them all now. If you remember your Rashi, you'll remember Rashi on the Pasuk. Look at the Pasuk in number 10, briefly. When Moshe gives a bracha to Levi, he says, this will remind you from your Simchat Torah Leini. Ura Levi Amar, Tumecha V'urecha Le'ish Chasidecha, Asher Nisito B'Masa. Okay, he tested that your Urim and Tumim, he says to God, are for your faith, for your the gracious one, the ones with grace. Asher Nisito B'Masa, you tested the B'Masa, Shirvenu Amei Meriva, Ha'omel Ha'aviv Le'imo Lo'ir Isiv. The tribe of Levi said, I don't look at who is my father or mother. They were there for Moshe at the Chet Ha'egel to kill anybody who was liable to the death penalty for Avodah Zarah. Ve'et Achiv Lo Hikir, Ve'et Banav Lo Yeda, or Lo Yada, and here's the word, Kishamru imratecha ubritecha yintoru. They kept your brit. Now Rashi says that they kept the brit where? In the Midbar, not in Egypt. In the Midbar. Meaning, all the way through the journey in the Midbar, the Jewish people did not perform brit milah. We see that in Yoshua, explicitly. Why not? It's dangerous. You might have to move today, you might have to move tomorrow. But Levi did. Levi performed brit milah anyway. Why? Because they're hotheads, they're zealous, they're kanaim. Oh, how were they allowed if it was dangerous? So the Mephoshim say, it wasn't really dangerous. It's just it was risky. So most of the Jewish people say, oh, it's risky, I'm not taking a risk. Levi says, I'll take the risk. But that's if you understand the Midrash to mean that they did brit milah in the Midbar. The Rambam reads this Midrash that they did brit milah in Egypt. You see how the way that you read this Midrash actually has a very significant implication for this halakha. Only if you read the Midrash like the Rambam can you use this example to answer the case of a baby who has a brit milah as a child thinking they're Jewish, but actually wasn't Jewish and needed to convert later. Fascinating way of using this Midrash in order to answer these halakha questions. Fine, let's go on and get into the real meat of things now. Page number 5. And this is going to raise all of the difficult questions that we're going to need for next week. Kabbalat HaMitzvot. So what exactly does a non-Jew need to accept in order to become Jewish? Number 15. Let's quickly read this. The Shulchan Aruch. We haven't seen this source. Although you'll see he brings very much from the Gemara, which we saw a couple of weeks ago. Let's read this together and we'll ask some difficult questions. Number 15. Says the Shulchan Aruch. Kishibali Itkaya. When someone comes to convert, Omrim Lo, what do we say to the person? Mara Itajibatil Itkaya. Why do you want to convert? We saw this before. The Jewish people now are despised, they're harassed, etc. Maturafim, Yisurim by Malayim, they have a terrible life. Im Amayt, he says, Yodeani, I know what the Jews have to go through, Ve'eini Kedai Lehitchaber Imam, and are still not worthy of joining them. So what's the first thing you need to ascertain? Do you want to be a member of the Jewish people? Yes or no? Before we talk about mitzvahs. If the answer is yes, we can go on. If the answer is no, then forget it. Before we even mention anything technical. So this is going to be a very important question. All of the Russians who came in the Russian Aliyah in the 1990s, late 90s and 2000s, who came to Israel, and many of them are not Jewish. Many, many of them are not Jewish. We'll see what the statistics are next week. Or they weren't Jewish when they came. And now they say, well, okay, we can convert. Well, what do you need to check? Do they want to be part of the Jewish people? Well, yes. They came to Israel. They could have gone and live in America. There's children fighting in the army. Some of them die in the army. So they definitely want to become part of the Jewish people. Do you want to keep mitzvahs? Not particularly. Well, does that matter? Which is more important? Which is the driver? Which is the passenger? Is it, I want to be a Jew, and then, oh, no, I'll keep what I keep? Or is it, no, I want to be a Jew, and I want to be a from Jew? That's the question. We'll see that next week. So then we know he wants to be Jewish. Number 15 in the middle of the second line. Moedim Oitzo Ikre Hadat. First of all, we teach him some of the principles of faith. Shehu Yichud Hashem, Isra Avodah Zorah, etc. This came in from the Rambam, for whom the principles of faith are very, very important. It wasn't in the Gemara, but we teach him the principles of faith. Umarichim Omba B'davazen, we go on at that in some length. Moedim Oitzo Mikas Mitzvahs Kalos, Mikas Mitzvahs Chamos. I'm going to read this quite quickly because we saw this. We teach him some of the lighter mitzvahs, some of the more serious mitzvahs, severe mitzvahs. Vodim oitzim mikros oishish ala mitzvah. We teach him some of the onshin. The ein marbim alav. We're not too harsh on him. The ein medakik alav. We're not too requiring of him. We're not too strict with Galen. We don't want to put them off. We want to put them off just enough, but not too much. V'kashem shemodim oto anshash ala mitzvahs. Just like we taught them about some of the punishment, kach moedim oso shcharon to mitzvah, so to the reward, moedim oso shabatis mitzvah, elu zekon yitke lachai olam haba, you go to olam haba, she'en shum tzadik gomo ele bal chochma, the only way you can go to olam haba is to have wisdom, learning, she'afa mitzvah, to do mitzvah, mitzvah elu v'yodam, and you have to know what they mean. So Omrinon, we say to him, have yodeh sha'olam haba, einu tzafon ele tzadikim, you do know that to get to olam haba, you have to be a tzadik, the Haim Yisrael, and now that you're Jewish, you have to be a Jewish tzadik. When you see Jews having trouble in this world, even what apparently are good Jews, they're going to get their reward in Olam Haba, not in Olam Hazeh. Fine. We go on at length to get them more excited. We want to get them into being Jewish. In Kebel, if they say, yes, let's do it, we give them a bris milah straight away. And we wait until they heal. Refuah Shalema till they get a complete healing from the circumcision. Then we take them to the mikveh. Tefillah Hogenis Baluch Hatzitza, proper halachic tefillah. Says the Ramah. V'yesh Omrim Sheigaleach Sarotav. Some people say you have to shave off all his hair or all her hair. V'yitzot Tzipranav Yadav V'raglav, and you have to cut down their nails, coat them tefillah. Interesting. Do you have to shave off your hair to go into the mikveh? Yes or no? If you're a Hungarian from the Chasen Sofa Minhagim, then the women do shave their head. This is a Ramah. It sounds like this is something maybe for the converts. There was a Minhag, by the way, if a Jew were apostatized, became a Christian, and then converted back. But they didn't really convert because they were always a Jew. But they put them through a quasi-conversion. They made them go to the mikveh, and they made them shave up all their hair and go to the mikveh, etc. Interesting question here. V'shloisha, brackets Talmidei Chachamim, very important brackets, three men who are, or are they not, Talmidei Chachamim, I'm the Magav of Moedim Oysa, then they say a second time, Mixas Mitzvahs Kalas, Mixas Mitzvahs Chamurot, Pam Shnir. The who I made the mind, and he stands in the water while they tell him all of this. Im Haisa'ish, and if it's a woman converting, Nashim Oshim Oshim Oshim, the women bring her into the mikvah, at Tzavara until her neck, the Hadayim in the Chutz, the Dayim stand outside, for Tzniut, they tell her through the door that there are things she needs to accept. She sits in the water, and then she goes to the mikveh under the water. And then they turn their heads so they can't see her. When she comes out of the water, she makes a bracha, or he makes a bracha. The cave and shetavol, important line, as soon as they go to the mikveh, Hari Huki Yisrael, they are Jewish. She'im chazar l'surah, and if they go back afterwards to lead a non-Jewish life, Hari Huki Yisrael Mumah, they're just like a Jew who is no longer religious. She'im kiddush, if they married a woman, kiddushav kiddushin. It's a marriage. You can't turn around and say, no, now that I see that you're not doing mikvahs, your conversion was never valid. No. Once it's a valid conversion, even if they go completely off the derech, they're like any other Jew that goes off the derech. And that's why, on page 6, at the bottom, and I'm not going to go inside, Rav Shlomo Zalman says, one of the reasons that we want to be so careful is that if you convert a non-Jew, and then they go off the derech, then all those aveiras are on the head of the dayanim. Because of litnei iva loisit en nichshol. You read this Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach afterwards. He says, just like you can't give a cup of wine to a nazir, so too you can't bring the nazir to the wine, and the mitzvah of litnei iver applies to both Jews and non-Jews. You can't give a avodah zarah to non-Jews. Litnei iver, it's a mitzvah on every Jew. So if you take this non-Jew, give him bad advice by converting him to be Jewish, with the good likelihood that they're not going to keep mitzvahs, then on your head be it. Literally. Well, not literally, but spiritually. So what does this mean? So let me leave you with a number of questions in the last couple of minutes. There have been many criticisms over the last 10, 15, 20 years made against many of the Batei Din in the Orthodox world about the way that they do conversions, especially in Israel. There have been some decisions made by the Rabbanut in Israel that they will not accept conversions done by other Batei Din in Europe or America in order to quote-unquote raise standards. Now, is that okay? Is that not okay? Is it okay for one Beit Din to say, I accept that one, but not this one, etc.? Does that work? There have been people who are women who are in their late 30s, early 40s. And one of the criticisms has been made, has been said, well, in order to convert, it takes years, and you have to study for years and years and years. And she's meanwhile saying, well, I want to be Jewish and I want to have a family. And I don't have years and years and years. And there's been an accusation in some quarters made that maybe there's not as much rachmanas. Think of how much rachmanas you need to have to a ger, how much sympathy, how much thought. Well, one second, that's only to a ger. That's not to a non-Jew who wants to be a ger, or is it? I put you in the footnotes a link to an article by Rabbi Michael Broyd about whether that mitzvah applies even to conversion candidates. Former Soviet Union, many, many people came, like I said, to Israel. There are tens of thousands of non-Jews living in Israel as Jews. Their children will very likely marry Jews. Maybe they'll have to go to Cyprus to marry them. Maybe by the time they get to marriageable age, they won't have to do that anymore either. This is not a good solution, leaving it as it is. Meaning, why do we want to be strict on conversion in Chutz La'aretz? Because we don't want to encourage people to marry non-Jews. Oh, okay, say, well, this is easy. You know, I met Christine, and then a couple of months later, I was married. So we don't want to do that because it's going to lead to assimilation. In Israel, it's exactly the opposite problem. We want to convert people. Otherwise, they will be intermarried and assimilation. It's the opposite issue. And just to leave you with an important case, in 1991, the conversion was carried out by Rav Drukman. Rav Drukman was the head of, and still very involved in, the conversion court system. There was a whole Rabbanut system of conversion courts set up. There was a Danish woman who came to Israel. She married, she converted in 1991. She married a Jewish man in an Orthodox ceremony. She had three children. In 2007, she got divorced. This was a court celebre about 15 years ago. And the Bet Din in Ashdod, they were dealing with the Gerushin, dealing with the get, they said, although she was traditional, she didn't keep Shabbos, she didn't go to the mikveh, and they said, well, it's clear to us that you were never Jewish in the first place. Your whole conversion was a sham, and therefore you don't need a get. That's the good news. The bad news is, you're not Jewish, your children are not Jewish, none of you are Jewish. So this was appealed up to the Bet Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim. Says, is there any such thing that you can turn back the clock 20 years later, 15 years later, and say you thought you were Jewish and now you're not Jewish? Why? Because you don't keep Shabbos? Because you don't go to the mikveh? And two out of three of the Dayanim in Yerushalayim decided they were going to overrule the Beis Din in Ashdod and hold that the conversion was a valid conversion. The third Dayan was Rav Avram Sherman, a very outspoken figure, a controversial figure, and he said, no, I agree with the Ashdod court. He says, okay, well, it's two against one. So he says, no, it's not, because I'm recusing myself and I'm taking myself out of the Beis Din. You can't do that. I just did that. Okay? And then he convened another Beis Din who overturned the conversion, who upheld the Ashdod ruling that the woman was not Jewish. And this became a major hashkafic battle where they were highly critical of Rav Drukman, delegitimized the Batei Din of Rav Drukman, etc. And this became then a debate about not is this woman a Jew or a non-Jew, but who should be in charge of Geirus in this country? Should it be the religious Zionist rabbis who have one agenda to try and get the nation to be a nation and connect together, either Jewish, or should it be the Haredi rabbis who have a different agenda? Everybody has an agenda. It's not like you have an agenda. No, everybody has an agenda. But which rabbis should be the ones pushing their agenda? Now that's a good question. That's an important question. Maybe this is not the right way to decide it or to debate it, but that's what we're going to get to next week. So if you can hold yourself until then, we will hopefully get there, Be'ezrat Hashem, next week. Have a wonderful week.